Welcome to Talking John, a podcast where University of Arkansas Chancellor Emeritus John White and I, Michelle Morris, pastor of First United Methodist Church in Bentonville, talk about what the Gospel of John means to us in scholarship and in our lives. In this episode of Talking John, we talk a little bit about sibling rivalry and if it matters where you come from. Enjoy. We are here in chapter 7, and this one of the things that I would love to invite you to talk about is what you learned about the Festival of the Tabernacles, because I think this is something that not a lot of Christians know about. I learned quite a bit about it from reading the work that you've done here. So why don't you share a little bit with us about what you learned about the Festival of the Tabernacles?
Well, it's one of the three mandatory feasts or festivals from the Old Testament. It's one that occurs, like it's the harvest time. It's in September, October, something like that. But it really is commemorating the 40 years in the wilderness, and in the wilderness that the people were living in, residing in temporary dwellings, often tents or what they might call booths, or in this case, the word tabernacles. And so the feast is sometimes referred to as the Feast of Booths or the Feast of the Indwellings, but it was representing the fact that the journey through the wilderness had come to an end. The law had been given by Moses. It's a mandatory feast, as I said, that every adult male who lived within 15 miles of Jerusalem must attend. But what separates this from the Passover is that actually the requirements and the invitation was not just extended to men, but it went to women and children. It went to slaves. It went to everyone to come and to celebrate this. And so if you were a, quote, foreigner, and you could come and participate in this. It went on for 7 days, and there was just a lot of sacrificing of animals that went on during this time as well. In fact, if I went through, I just wanted to know, so I counted them up and went strictly by what it was saying one must do in Numbers, where you can find all the numbers about basically everything.
It's a very accounting-based book.
It really is.
Very appropriately named.
Yes. Oh, my goodness. You start out, you know, with the number of bulls, the number of this, and all up. It's like almost 191. Not quite 191. Why? Because at the end of the feast, there is the Day of Atonement. And the Day of Atonement, there are also some sacrifices. So if you add in the animals that are sacrificed on the eighth day, the Day of Atonement, 191 animals are sacrificed.
Wow.
So a lot of sacrificing. And also accompanying this is a lot of pouring of water on during this, when the priests are doing this. So there's water is very evident. And also you find that there's a lot of blood around. So here the water is washing away the blood off of the altar there in the temple. And so it fits in very nicely with about Jesus then coming to about water later on in the chapter.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting to read what it shows up in three different books in the Pentateuch about the Feast of the Tabernacle. So it wasn't one you should just sort of overlook. You as a Jew would know this is the one you want to go to. So you're going to have a lot of people there. I mean, it's one estimate would be that at this time there'd be at least 150,000 people coming in and into Jerusalem for this festival. So the setting is there. And the way the chapter begins, it's after this. Well, after what? Well, in the previous chapter, where many of his disciples left him because of this hard saying, and they're about eat my flesh and drink my blood and so forth in the previous chapter. So now we find that people, the Jewish leaders are wanting to get Jesus. So he's out, he gets away, he's in Galilee, he stays there. And depending upon how you want to measure the time, he's gone for at least 6 months. We don't know what happens during this 6 month period, but we have the belief that he's performing a number of miracles. Why? Because if we only relied strictly on John's accounting of miracles in Galilee, there were very few. In fact, it would be turning water into wine would be one. And so there just weren't, he wasn't doing a lot, but so his brothers, and this is again an interesting part about this chapter, it starts off with right at the beginning, we get into a bit of controversy. Because right off,
family, imagine.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. After this, Jesus went around in Galilee. He did not want to go about in Judea because the Jewish leaders there were looking for a way to kill him. But when the Jewish festival of Tabernacles was near, Jesus' brothers said to him, "Leave Galilee and go to Judea so that your disciples there may see the works you do. No one who wants to become a public figure acts in secret. Since you're doing these things, show yourself to the world." And then John adds, "For even his brothers did not believe in him." Mm-hmm. So the great debate then is, okay, who are his brothers? Mm-hmm. Within the Catholic Church, the position of Mary, the tradition is that she did not give birth to any other children.
Right.
However, when you look at Matthew and Luke, and all, they don't go along with that. They start naming who his brothers, half-brothers are, let's put it that way, are that they are Mary's children, other children, younger, obviously, than Jesus. Well, to sort of find middle ground, if you will, a number of the early commentaries would say, well, brothers could mean anyone that was related, so it could be cousins. So, and I tried to figure out where do I fall on this. Well, I wanted to believe that it would be his brothers, but then at the end of the Gospel of John, we know that when Jesus is on the cross, he gives the responsibility of his mother to John, not to one of his half-brothers.
Right.
And so I've had to go round and round about that. And I've been off and on that. Where I am right now, at this moment in time, let's not ask me an hour later.
Okay.
This moment in time, I think that because Jesus knew what was in the hearts of people, knew what they were about, he knew that he could depend on John to take care of his mother, Mary. That's why he gave him the responsibility and did not give that responsibility to any of his half-brothers if they were, in fact, offspring of Mary. So that's kind of where I am now. I think that he felt like the best person to be responsible for his mother was John, the gospel writer. So that's where I am on it.
Okay. Well, I see that moment between Mary and John, which we will return to when we get to the Passion. I actually see that as a symbolic moment of Jesus, in a sense, birthing the church, in that he takes Mary, his mother, who was really, in many ways, the first disciple.
Yes.
The one who kicked off his ministry, right? By saying, you know, go get the jugs and do what he says, even though he says it's not my time. Jesus, go, you know, we talked about that whole mother son moment mm-hmm. went on there. So his mother really kicks off his ministry. And I think, and we know from Acts that she remains a significant part of the church going forward. And then John as the beloved disciple. If that is what we understand, if we understand the beloved disciple as John, it's never explicitly named in mm-hmm. the Gospel of John, but most scholars will say that's the case. that bringing them together as family is giving birth to the church. And it's funny that you mentioned the presence of water and blood at the Feast of the Tabernacles, because water and blood is also present at the cross when, of course, obviously bleeding from the wounds, but then when he pierces the side and the water comes forward, mm-hmm. which is a detail given to us in John, that is a kind of a pouring forth of those two liquids in that space as well, which also happens at birth. There's the breaking of the water, and then mm-hmm. there's blood in when people are born. So it's, for me, that's where I tend to usually stand, is what Jesus is doing in that moment has less to do with whether she had literal sons, biological sons that could take care of her, and more to do with the kind of public naming of, this is the church now. This is when the church is born. It is born of this mother and this son, and they will carry the mission forward from there. So that's where I go with that moment.
Well, I love that. So I'm now going to go to that chapter, and I'm going to make some modifications in what I've written. Well, I probably won't give you credit, but anybody that listens to this.
It's not my credit to give. Yes. I learned this from other scholars, you know.
Oh, so, okay.
So that's where I definitely would sit in that space. But I think it's a good idea to bring back the brothers, right? To think about mm-hmm. these brothers and to think about the dynamic of what's going on here. The fact that they're named brothers, whether they are literal brothers of his, like biological brothers of his, or brothers in the sense of companions, you know,
yep.
regardless, you're using a very close familial term in that space, and they doubt.
Yes, they do.
I think it's definitely to point out that the people that know Jesus best, or are supposed to know Jesus best, still don't see who he is.
Yeah, well, and also imagine what it must have been like.
Oh.
If you're a half brother, who's the golden child?
Right, exactly. I mean, he's the golden child of all golden children, right?
Exactly. Of all, the goldest of child.
That's right.
Oh, goodness. Don't you think that there has to have been just a bit of irritation? That's a nice word. Not jealousy. Oh, no. Jealousy? Oh, no. Enmity? Oh, no. Heaven forbid. No. But just a little irritation about the golden child. And so John goes forward and he says, and they didn't even believe in him. And so,
right.
Thanks, John. I'm sure the piling on has begun.
That's right. Nice side commentary here.
Yes.
For me also, I mean, when you think about sibling rivalry is mm-hmm. so, first of all, it's so human. I don't know. Do you have brothers and sisters?
I do have a sister. Younger than I.
Okay. Did you have a lot of sibling rivalry?
Actually, not as far as I was concerned, but I think it put a lot of pressure on her being the younger sister. And all, but it's even now when we're sometimes together, it becomes competitive on just the list of things, you know. And I see it in our son and daughter. I see it in other children around. Yeah. It's real.
It's real. It's real. My brother and I absolutely had sibling rivalry. I was a really good student, so he had that shadow to follow. Mm-hmm. Although there was another girl in his class whose name was Mandy, it had the same last name as we did, and her mm-hmm. name was Mandy, and my brother's name's Mark. So the teachers would always get to Mandy first, and they would say, "Are you Michelle's sister?" And she would say, "No." And then since my brother Mark never spoke up, they just assumed he would have said, "No, that's my sister," but he didn't. So a lot of times, teachers didn't know. We were related until my mom showed up for parent-teacher conferences. And by then, usually they loved my brother so much. He was not as good a student as I was, but my brother is very charismatic.
Yeah.
And so they didn't do a whole lot of comparison because they liked him who he was for the most part there. In fact, we part of our sibling rivalry was I would say, you know, I get all these friends and then they meet you and you still my friends.
Yes.
So, but I think it's just, it's a natural thing. We would fight and we'd have dumb fights too. Like who, which one of us the dog loved better, you know?
Yes.
Those kinds of things. It's just true to who humanity is. And I think part of it is because they're the people that do know you the best. So they've seen you in your best moments, but they've also definitely seen you in the worst.
Yeah. And, oh, I've seen it in our daughter's two girls and in our son's son and daughter, that the rivalry. In fact, our daughter's two daughters both play tennis players. And so Mary Lib was down taking care of them while their mom and dad were traveling somewhere. And she overhears the youngest one go to the coach and said, "Teach me something that my sister doesn't know how to do." So, I mean, you're right. It is, and it's certainly, it has to have existed at that time because and then even, let's just setting that aside, interestingly, why then do the brothers want him to go? Well, is it for him or is it for themselves?
You right. Know,
I suspect that they think there's something in it for us. It's that whole business about how the famous, they find out they've got more relatives than they ever thought they had.
Yeah.
People come out of the woodwork and suddenly they're following them. And so they're saying, hey, go down. This is it. There can be 150,000 people there. It's going to be your chance to do these things. And oh, boy. And you'll become the king. And by the way, will you have a place in your administration for me?
Right.
And
I think for them, see, it's kind of a no-lose situation on one sense, right? Because if they go and Jesus is really successful, then you're right. They get to kind of bask in that glory. Mm-hmm. But if he goes and he falls on his face, then they get to laugh that the golden child fell on his face.
That's right.
So, you know, I just as my experience of siblings, I'm just going to say.
Yeah.
And I mean, this also ties deeply into the biblical narrative. I mean, basically the second major narrative story in the Bible itself is one of famous sibling rivalry.
Oh, yes.
Abel.
Yeah.
And that goes to disastrous ends. And then the words that they're using here, just this kind of interplay between the brothers that happens here, for me, recalls the story of Joseph from Genesis. Not Joseph, Jesus' dad, but the Joseph from Genesis. And the kind of resentment that the brothers had for how he was the favored son, and where they do lead Joseph ultimately into a place of danger. And so we have this pattern in the Bible where brothers don't necessarily take good care of their brother.
Yeah.
So I think there's just some echoes of that happening here as well.
There's also the nice sort of dynamic rears its head when they say, "Let's go." And Jesus says, "No, I'm not going." And what he didn't say is, "I'm not going with you."
Right.
I'll go at my time. Any time is good for you. But there's a special time when I should go. And that time is when the Father deems it's appropriate that I be there, which winds up being the middle of the feast.
Right.
The middle of the feast, when you're going to have the largest audience possible. And what does he do? He shows up in the temple and he's teaching.
Yeah.
Imagine how his brothers must have felt then. Wait a minute. Who is that? I thought he wasn't coming. I've been telling everybody he wasn't coming. And here he is.
Here he is.
Just can't depend on that guy.
Right.
Just can't depend.
Well, he sure isn't including us. I mean, I can see him definitely thinking that. So, but I also think it's worthwhile to reflect on this idea of return to the idea of the people who know us best don't always see us, and thinking in terms of the misunderstanding of who Jesus is and how they're judging by appearances, right? So we certainly see that the crowd is making a lot of assumptions about Jesus. We're really getting into this point where we have just a lot more controversy. As we've said, the controversy in this section of John is really amping up, and Jesus is facing a lot of resistance. And some of the resistance here is just misunderstanding or misreading of who Jesus is, or assumptions that they're making because of his background, right? Who are you to make these claims? So I'd love to hear some stories in which you have either judged people yourself based on appearances, or you have been judged, or just experiences you've had where assumptions have been made about people based on their appearance or based on their background, where it's been then surprising.
Well, certainly there have been many instances where I have judged incorrectly. Just about every mistake I think one could make, I've made in that regard, that it's based on first appearances, that the first reaction I'd have could be favorable or unfavorable because of how someone was dressed or how much they weighed or whatever it might be, to say, I just don't think that's going to be a good candidate. But then also we go by things like, where did they go to school? Where are they from? Who was their advisor? And those kinds of things come to play. And I was absolutely off on the hiring of one of the department heads at Georgia Tech when I was dean, that there was a person that I wanted to get somebody else, someone from outside, and we worked and worked to do that. And so then I wound up settling on someone inside. Well, it turns out that was probably the best hiring decision that I made while I was dean. I mean, what he did was amazing, but I was discounting it because he didn't come from the top schools for his degree. All of this, these kinds of things I was making decisions on. It was just wrong. And even take that aside, I remember, and this I do share in chapter 15, going to a Methodist men's retreat. And when the evangelist that they had to come to speak to us walked out on stage, and I just thought, oh, this is a disaster. Well, it turned out to be probably the greatest impactful speaker I've ever heard.
Oh, wow.
But I just immediately had discounted him.
Yeah.
And so I've made so many mistakes like that. And I've been in situations where I was discounted because of where I'm from, namely from Arkansas, from the University of Arkansas, instead of from, say, MIT or Berkeley or Stanford or something like that. And so you go through life, and there are going to be people who will accept or reject you wrongly. So that gets into the two types of errors: accepting someone who should be rejected and rejecting someone who should be accepted.
Right.
The type one and type two errors. That rejecting someone who should have been accepted, that's a type one error. Type two is accepting someone who should have been rejected. Well, those wind up being very visible.
Yeah.
And I was involved in the hiring of two basketball coaches that it was a mistake in both instances. And the person that we did not choose wound up in two instances going on to the Final Four, and one of them winning a national championship.
Oops.
So I mean, fortunately, it's not as visible on the ones you reject that you should have accepted. But it's highly visible on the ones you accept that should have been rejected because
right.
they wound up failing. And right. So, I mean, I've made all those mistakes, Michelle, and I have been the subject of some that also that I think I was able to show them.
I think it's human, right? I mean, I don't think anybody gets through life without making some assumptions that we regret later.
Yeah.
When you were talking about the Methodist men speaker, I had an opportunity once to hear Walter Brueggemann in person speak. And I love his writing. And I didn't go. And the reason that I didn't go was because I had come across too many other biblical scholars that I had admired their work. And then I would go hear them speak and they would be so vitriolic and so condescending and so kind of holier than thou that I couldn't take that happening to Walter Brueggemann in my head. I was like, no, I need him to stay pristine. And so I need to not go see him because as soon as I go see him in person, he's going to disappoint me. And then all the people that went to it just came back regaling it. What an incredible speaker he was, and warm and hospitable and humble and all this. And I was like, daggum it.
Absolutely.
But what I was doing was I was allowing my experience of other people, which is really what we're doing when we make those kinds of judgments, right?
Yeah.
I was allowing my experience of other people prejudice me against what could have been a wonderful experience. I did have a chance to go see him later, and I took it, and he was absolutely incredible. And I'm so grateful I got a second chance to go see him. And then, of course, like you, I have been the recipient of judgment, in part for being from Arkansas as well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people making assumptions about what that meant for me as an educated person. But probably where I encounter more judgment is as a woman pastor. And that's just part of the job. At this point, you just know that's coming. And you learn to, in many ways, sometimes be graceful about it because I understand where people are coming from, but sometimes not. And I will tell people when people ask me, how do we address you? I get this question a lot. People usually know how to address a male pastor, but they don't know what to do with a woman pastor. And so I say, the way I want you to address me is however you are comfortable addressing me. You can say Michelle, you can say Pastor Michelle, you can say, some people call me Dr. Morris, some people call me Reverend Dr. Morris, just whatever feels comfortable to you. And I tell people, I don't insist on my titles because I didn't get the titles for my own glory. I got the titles to serve God better, or not necessarily better, to serve God in more ways than if I didn't have the titles, and to make me available for that kind of service. And I don't insist on them because they are really gifts for God. Unless someone questions my capability for what is an arbitrary reason, which I would say, because I am a woman, that's an arbitrary reason, right? Mm-hmm. And if they get a little judgy in that space, they're liable to get hit with the titles. I'm just going to be honest. But I think it's just human. It's human. It's part of our brokenness. It's part of why we need Jesus, right? And part of what Jesus shows us, because he does come as a regular person from Galilee without the pedigree, and brings, as you talk about in this chapter, the capital T truth, right? That people resist so much throughout all of this, you know? So we would all do well, I think, to remember that. To remember to try to look with God's eyes instead of our own when we are coming into contact with others. Okay, well, let's see what else we got. You want to talk more about the water?
Well, I think this is a useful thing to remember now the setting in the tabernacles, Feast of the Tabernacles, that there's all of this that's going on. And so then verse 37 says, on the last and greatest day of the festival, Jesus stood and said in a loud voice, let anyone who is thirsty come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as scripture has said, rivers of living water will flow from within them. I thought, how interesting that the first time that he declared openly that he was the Messiah was to the Samaritan woman, the woman at the well, mm-hmm. this Amanda. Mm-hmm. And there it was, he used water there to convey who he was.
Yes.
And here, with this festival, with all of this water that has been poured in now, he surely that has brought to mind that, yes, now is the time. I suspect he was thinking about that rather than thinking about Samantha, though Samantha would like to take some credit for this, I'm sure.
Well, and, I mean, it's the same. It's really the same imagery.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's powerful imagery. And as you just pointed out, in both cases, really, in Samantha's story and in this moment in the Festival of the Tabernacles, water is palpably present. So Jesus is helping people understand these big God concepts with the concrete reality that is around them. And I think that is so indicative of the fact that, well, in one way, it's indicative of the incarnation, right? Which is that God really and the holiness permeates our world. It's not separate from our world. God is present in and can be conveyed by the concrete reality that is around us. That reality can carry the symbolic spiritual world that Jesus is inviting people into. The question is whether they receive it or not, but it imbues a holiness into the everyday. And it's also a really good teaching technique. I mean, we've talked about what a great teacher he is.
Yes.
And being able to use the reality that is around you helps people grasp concepts. You know?
Yeah, but I think that with John, who's writing this, that he didn't connect it to Samantha. Mm-hmm. I think he probably connected it to Nicodemus. I brought Nicodemus in again.
We're back. But that's there's a good reason for bringing in Nicodemus.
Yes, there is.
Because he is talking about how, what does it say? By this, he meant the spirit that
yes.
who believed in him were later able to receive. Up to that, the time had not been given. So we've got water in the spirit.
Yes, right.
That's present here again.
And
right?
what did Jesus say to Nicodemus? Unless you've been born of water and the Spirit.
Exactly.
So John was probably thinking about Nicodemus.
Although
but I was thinking about Samantha.
I think that I'm going to give John credit for thinking about both, because those two stories come so back to back, right? And we talked about the kind of polar opposites that they were in many ways. And yet they're really, Jesus is trying to get both of them to understand the same reality. Samantha just catches on to it faster, right?
Yeah. there you go again. This is akin to sibling rivalry, I can tell.
It really is. But I think really you can't miss either one of them in this space. And I think they are inextricably tied to one another. Samantha and Nicodemus are linked. And then this same imagery keeps showing up and carrying through. And as a storyteller, as John is a storyteller, because the gospel writers are storytellers, right? We have four very distinct gospels. We've talked about this. Four very distinct gospels, because they're different storytellers telling to different audiences. And, you know, these words that continue to echo across the gospel are obviously images and realities that John found meaningful in John's understanding of Christ, but also that obviously it helps this community understand whoever John is writing to in the moment. But also, these are universal symbols that he's working with. Water is needed by all of humanity. And water does the same thing for all of humanity. Water sustains life and cleanses us and gives us joy and has potential destructive power when it's out of its banks, so to speak, but nourishes us, strengthens us, sustains us. All of those things are true about water universally. And in the absence of it is really, life can't sustain. Have you seen, this is a ridiculous movie. So it's an interesting social commentary. If you haven't seen it, I won't be surprised, but it's a movie called Idiocracy. Have you seen it?
No.
And it is, it's this idea that humanity has basically dumbed itself down. And there are two people that are frozen in a cryogenic experiment in like the early 2000s or something like that. And they get forgotten about. And then they wake up like 400 years later. And humanity has totally, we've become idiots, in all honesty. And the crops that they're trying to grow, they're using a Gatorade substance. I think it's called Brondo. I can't remember exactly, but it's basically a sports drink. They're trying to water the crops with a sports drink because they're like, it revives your muscles, so it's got to be good for the earth. And of course, no crops are growing and all of this. And one of the people that's come back from having been cryogenically frozen was like, why don't you use just water? And they were like, what? That's what you put in the toilets. No, we need water. And the crops start growing and everyone thinks he's a genius, right? This is a ridiculous movie, but it in a strange way illustrates this very point that life cannot sustain without water.
Yeah.
And really, life cannot sustain without Christ either. It's raining right now where I am. What about you?
Oh, it's not raining here. No, not where I am.
It's raining. It's raining a lot.
Well, I'm all for that, except when I'm on the golf course.
Right.
Thank you very much. But, it's interesting that at this point, despite all of the opposition that's coming Jesus' way, that in this chapter, we say that the crowd is divided.
Uh-huh.
Some are saying he's the Messiah. Others saying, no, he couldn't possibly be because he's from Galilee.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how often have we heard that? No, he can't be. He's from Arkansas.
Yep. But,
so what happens? And this is one of my favorite parts of John. I just love it. That Sanhedrin, they're just already, they're going to get him. So they send the temple guards to go and listen to him and bring him back to us. And so here come the temple guards. Well, Where is he? Oh, never have we heard anyone speak like this man speaks. Never.
And right.
What are you? You're demon possessed. What's wrong with you? You can't see that. Well, not only that, I can imagine that the temple guards didn't just go down and just stay for 5 minutes and come back. They watched everything Jesus was doing from the middle of the festival to the end of the festival, and then they came. Well, not only did they hear his words, but during the time that he was there, I'm sure that he was also doing memorable, remarkable, miraculous things. So not only did they get to hear what he said, they got to see what he did. But they come back, and the only thing that they really addressed was no one ever spoke like this man spoke. Which also is interesting to me that nowhere in this, not only in this gospel, but the other gospels, do the Jewish leaders ever call into question the accuracy of what Jesus did. They only call into question, well, I say what he did. I'm talking about the miracles. They certainly called into question what he did if he healed on the Sabbath and had his disciples pluck the grains and ate that on the Sabbath. But they never question that.
He turned water into wine.
Yeah. They didn't question. Yeah.
He fed all the 5,000.
Yeah. I mean, even though they get Lemuel and they're really what they want to do, they want to nail him for carrying his pallet or bed on the Sabbath, not the fact that he was healed after 38 years of being an invalid. No, and then they want to go after Jesus for doing it. So these temple guards come back and they say, never have we heard anyone speak like this man speaks. Well, I can just see the anger and everything that came from it. So what do? And this is going to come up time and time again, that when the Jewish leaders can't come up with anything else to do, they will go in and they will accuse them of being demon possessed or something. They'll attack them about their credibility. And then they say, what? You can't possibly be that. They say, have any of the rulers of the Pharisees believed in him? No. But this mob that knows nothing of the law, there is a curse on them. It says, well, they obviously haven't heard from Joseph of Arimathea yet, and they haven't heard from Nicodemus yet.
No, but they may not hear from Nicodemus.
That's right. Oh, they do. They do. They do. They do. They do.
They hear. He raises a question.
Yes, but he raises the question.
Okay, fair. I'll give him the question.
and so then, what does Nicodemus say? He says, does our law condemn a man without first hearing him to find out what he has been doing?
Yeah.
And so what do? They accuse him of being from Galilee. Are you saw too?
Right. It's all this judging books by their cover.
Yes,
right?
Indeed.
All over the place. This.
My goodness.
Yeah.
You know, the before we end our discussion of chapter 7, we must mark how it ends. Depending on translations, it ends with a comma, not a period. So stay tuned.
Right.
For what's coming next.
For what's coming next. What's
but
after the comma?
Notice what they did. That these people that were against Jesus, they were so upset. What did they do? They went and they spent the night plotting, coming up with a way to trap him.
Yeah. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Talking John. You may have heard us make reference to the commentary that Chancellor White has written. It is not actually published yet. We hope to bring that to you at some time in the future. In the meantime, we hope you enjoy our conversation around the fourth gospel. We would love for you to share this resource with others, and giving us 5 stars will help it get pushed out. Thanks for joining us.